When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Tracy Koga, and thanks for downloading this podcast from ilikehugh.com. If you can, give us a follow or a subscribe. And remember that all the information about the guests in today's episode can be found at ilikehugh.com. Now, let's get started. Hello everyone, welcome to Hugh at Home, I'm Tracy Koga. While I have been feeling very patriotic and a lot of love for my country, Japan, on Sunday, Hideki Matsuyama donned the green jacket and became the Masters champion and the very first Japanese golfer to do so. He is going to go home and be congratulated. He'll be a national hero, and there is rumor he might be the torchbearer for the Olympics. What an incredible year. Well, coming up first, though, I will sit down with author Sally Ito and look more into our own historical family roots here in Canada with the Japanese Canadians. And then later on, Ona Lu will come on the show and she'll talk about her new album, her life here in Winnipeg, and what it means to be writing and creating music during the pandemic. So don't go away. It's all coming up on Hugh at Home. Every once in a while, you get to read a book that really hits home. And this one definitely was for me, The Emperor's Orphans by Sally Ito. And it is a great honor and a pleasure to actually, well, you know, I guess the better thing would be, Sally, for you to be right here in the same room. But no, thank you so much for joining us on Hugh at Home. Welcome. And thank you for this book. And I know that it deals with a lot of Japanese history, but really, Sally, all families are so alike, and I think share the same kind of beliefs and stories, hidden stories, secrets. But, you know, once you truly learn more about your family, I think it really truly helps you find out more about yourself, and especially if you do have family yourself, then, right, it makes the story complete. So let's go back. Let's talk about The Emperor's Orphans and how it all began for you, because it really is quite a revelation, I think, in its sense, too, for you.
Yeah, well, for me, I always did kind of, as a writer, wanted to write about my family and the family history. But it was just, it was how to do it. And I was very conscious that I thought my story wasn't really that important. I thought it was important to tell the story of my Japanese Canadian great aunt and my parents who had been through the war and through it being interned and then exiled to Japan. And I also wanted to talk about my mother's family who had been in Japan during the war. And I didn't really think my voice was very important, but as I wrote it, I realized more and more that I needed to be a voice because I was the storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I needed to know, I needed to be part of this narrative. So the book is set up in such a way that there are the important storytellers, my great aunt and my maternal grandfather, Toshiro. And then there's me, just sort of explaining who they are and how they influenced me and what they thought.
So I wanted to ask, though, a little bit into the history, because I just, again, recently found out. I mean, we knew and understood about the redress and the internment, but there was another part of that too, where the government was ready to ship Japanese Canadians who were born in Canada back to Japan. And like you say, exiled. And this was a very important part of your book. So that didn't necessarily happen in my family, but I found it interesting in how when they got to Japan, it wasn't, they were foreigners in a sense, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, the interesting thing about the repatriation policy, as it was called, was that people were making decisions because they were dispossessed of their property and they couldn't return to the West Coast. And this was a thing that was different between the Americans and the way that Japanese Americans were treated and Japanese Canadians were treated was this repatriation option. And it contributed to the, you know, to the exiling of people like my grandmother, who was Canadian by birth, and my father and his brothers, who were born in Canada, as effectively it was a kind of exile. They had really no say in the decision, so you know, it was kind of that sort of situation.
Yeah, and for yourself too, I guess growing up, Sally, if we talk about the way you felt and your own family life, and you talk about assimilation and just fitting in and, you know, wearing all the modern clothes and everything like that. And I kind of think about, too, I mean, we did grow up in the exact same era. And, you know, for me, I guess I consider myself fortunate. I didn't feel any different, but it's, you know, it's always a different situation for any other person too as well. So for you, what was it like for yourself growing up?
Well, you know, I grew up in Alberta in the predominantly white suburb of Sherwood mm-hmm. Park, just outside of Edmonton. So I was quite conscious that I was really really one of the few Asian kids in my entire high school. It was a big high school. There are other racial minorities there, of course, but overall, I would say that it was more or less white. There were maybe a few Black students, a few South Asian students, and there were also other Japanese Canadians that had come from Southern Alberta. But I felt like I was in a sea of whiteness, and you know, you're not really thinking that consciously about it. But you know, as you get to your high school and stuff, you do start to notice things, you know, like that. And I was going to Japanese language school, and I was aware that I was always speaking Japanese at home. And so the culture was different at home than it was outside. So there was, you know, there was that kind of bifurcated sense of being in two worlds, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's interesting, too, because you did keep up your Japanese, going to Japanese school, learning about the culture, speaking it. So what was it, or when was it, that you really wanted to learn more about yourself and that you wanted to learn more about your heritage?
Well, I would say it was probably in high school. I really sensed by that point that I needed to go to Japan, you know, like I felt like that's where everything was. That's where the language was. That's where people that looked like me were, and people that looked like my mom were. So I was taken to Japan in high school by my father for a 2-week trip. And after that, I was just hooked. I couldn't wait until I could go back again. And then I did a gap year in Japan, you know, after high school. Mm-hmm. And that desire never stopped. Like I still continue wanting to go to Japan. And yeah, so it started in high school and just never really stopped, yeah.
And then you took your family back there.
Yes.
What was that whole experience like? Because by then, I mean, the story was almost, you know, you had all your information almost and being able to share now with your family. What was that like?
Well, that was really interesting because, you know, I never grew up in Japan. I never experienced childhood in Japan. But I really wanted my kids to have an experience of that. So I took them in 2011, and we went twice in 2007 and 2011. And I had heard that in order for the language to sort of really be rooted in a child, you should have them immersed in the language at least once or twice before the age of 12. So I really did have that in mind, and I thought I really wanted to have my children exposed to that. So they had an experience that I've never had, which was to go to elementary school in Japan and junior high school for my son at that time. And they had a really interesting experience, and they understood what it was like to be a mixed race kid from Canada in Japan in a Japanese school. And I think that was a very unique experience for them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like role reversal. In all your times going back to Japan, did you notice a change in the people, or is it always the same? Like somehow I've only been there once, and I kind of think that it's almost like you're it's frozen in time, and it's, they're just the same, very stoic and yes. busy and, and super clean, but.
Yes.
Have you noticed a change, though, with everything that's happening in the world? Yes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. When I was there in my gap year in high school, I would get into the train and everybody's heads were black, So I felt like I would describe the stream flowing out of the subway cars and trains as being a river of black heads. And then really the next time I went, everybody was dyeing their hair, right? So, I mean, you had blue and blonde and pink and everything. This is what's so fascinating about Japanese culture, too, is it's kind of always undergoing this change. And you kind of have to keep going there to witness that change. And I think maybe for Japanese Canadians who have only been there like once, it's kind of locked in your memory. And there's this kind of sense that the traditional things are what represent Japan. Whereas in Japan, it's just this kind of complex mixing and matching of things. And a lot of the times, traditional things are losing their hold on Japanese mm-hmm. people. Interestingly enough, the Japanese Canadians and Japanese North Americans are looking to the traditional and are amazingly keeping it alive in North America in a way that it may not be happening in Japan. Yeah.
I think it's learning about all those stories, definitely. I maybe want to just digress from the book a little bit, Sally, and just sort of talk about the issues and the racism that... Yes. is very prominent right now, especially towards Asians. And it's just, how do you kind of deal with it? What are your views on it? Obviously, it's, if you boil it down to it, it's, people just don't understand and, they're allowing their own ignorance to kind of come to the surface. But I mean, a lot of this is really awful. And, always, it's usually pointed toward elderly, which is a really growing concern.
Yeah, I was really surprised by the attacks on elderly people in the U.S. And I think also we're seeing a lot of it because, we're all connected on social media. And, I had an interesting sort of moment of, like, I was watching this, but I felt, people were asking me, are you feeling any racism here? And I think, well, no, I'm not feeling it. I don't feel it in the same way. But then at the same time, as I was thinking about this, I'm on the Community Council for the Landscapes of Injustice Project, which is a huge project that's looking at the dispossession of Japanese Canadians. And they just launched their digital archive. And so I was able to go into my family's papers. And when I look at the letters that were exchanged between the custodian's office and my great aunt and other people were talking about their experiences of going into the archive, you can really see the racism. You can see the bureaucratic antipathy towards Japanese Canadians. You can see how the way the custodian wrote about their lands and how they devalued their lands and said that they were messy and unkempt. And that was not true at all. In fact, but they would write it that way so that they could devalue the property and then sell it for a lot less than it was worth. And I just thought, wow, that's this. Of course, we come from a legacy of this, and I've just completely forgotten about that. And then I needed to tell my kids mm-hmm. that. I said, like, do you know that this is what happened to your great aunt and your grandparents? It was there in the past, and it's rearing its head again. So you need to be aware that you come from a legacy of that. And you might think that you're not facing any racism now, but I think you need to also know that your story has some of that in there.
Yeah. And I mean, it is in our nature and culture to, be very passive, stoic, not say, not complain, just go with the flow. Yes. This is so Asian.
Yes.
And I mean,
true.
And
true.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe words of wisdom or whatever, Sally, because of, I mean, that's your profession, words. And
yes,
words can be so good. And it's just like, oh, I wish I said that. Because now, I mean, like, if we see it, we have to act on it. But on the other hand, you know, safety is a factor, right? And there's that part of us, we're just saying, okay, let's, you know, maybe stick our heads in the sand and it'll all go away.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I think it is true with Japanese people generally. They you know, they have that saying, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. And we have the saying in English, the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? I mean, and those two, and also in Japanese culture, there's an idea that it's better to be like a bamboo, which is to sway, you know, sway with the twine, and then you won't be broken, right? Because I think there's a lot to be appreciated in that thinking in the culture. But one thing I did realize when I was working with the Landscapes of Injustice project was that there were a number of very angry people, Japanese Canadians, who wrote letters to the government and who wrote letters to the custodian, who took the country to the Supreme Court. And I think we, as Japanese Canadians, need to say, you know, yes, we have a legacy of being angry and standing up for ourselves, and don't think that, you know, we shouldn't act on that legacy too. Let's not bury that. It was there. And now that it's been uncovered, let's look to that legacy and say, this is how we can speak up again, because actually some of our Nisei elders did that.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And you know what, I guess lastly, or as to wrap things up, for yourself, Sally, I mean, to be able to write a family story is pretty incredible, but you must have changed a lot too in this whole process.
Oh yeah, I did. I did a lot. And it's continuing all the time. Like even having once more again access to my family's archives digitally has just opened up new thoughts, new ideas. I was able to share those with family members, and I was able to share them with my children, which is a really valuable thing. And so I feel like you can never be tired in a way of your family story, because it's constantly evolving. And I realize now my children are mixed race, and that's a whole different ball game of identity that I don't know, and I don't really understand. And that's another place I want to explore, you know, with them.
Oh, because yes, they are the way of the future. And we do have children too that are mixed race, and yeah, I think another book on that alone would be, you know, something that I think that everybody, you know, should share and read. And although this is the Ito family history, it's anybody's family, I think, you know, and especially when you're going back to the motherland or anything like that, and to learn more about your culture, I think will be the first steps towards anti-racism, right? Learning about other cultures and understanding. So hopefully a book like this, I think a book like this should be in schools, really.
Yes, well, yeah, thank you. I hope so. I hope it gets read in schools too. There's an Italian anthropologist who said, there's no such thing as race, there's only culture. And I thought that was a very interesting comment. I think it's so true. And you know, we grow up with other cultures around us, and we have to be mindful of that, and we have to be inquisitive about that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we might be blunt with our questions and kind of rude, but you know, we have to have a dialogue, and we have to just not think of them as that other stranger that looks different, mm-hmm. or that's on the other side of the road or is in some other place, but we're having an encounter with them, so we need to have curiosity and engage in conversation with people other than ourselves.
Oh, most definitely. Well, it's pretty hard in this pandemic and isolation, but thank goodness for Zoom.
Yes.
Well, it's been so wonderful to meet you, Sally. Can't wait for the next book. And thank you personally. It meant a lot. So The Emperor's Orphans, I would suggest getting it. It's a great little read. And once again, Sally Ito, thank you so much for being here.
What's up? Ooh, say what's up?
Want to give a warm Winnipeg welcome to Ona Lu, and though you are so internationally known, I am so happy to know that Winnipeg is your home. So my first question to you, Ona Lu, is give us a little bit on your history and how Winnipeg became your landing place, I guess, so to speak.
We're living in the United States at the moment because I went to college there, and my husband did too. And we wanted to try living elsewhere. Argentina has been in a constant crisis since, like, my whole life. And being an artist, particularly, is very hard. So we wanted to try somewhere else. And we kept meeting people who had lived in Canada or who were living in Canada or who live in Canada and kept hearing these wonderful things. And my husband has a cousin here in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, like, everything aligned and we felt like it was worth the shot. And we came 5 years ago and we love it. Like, if anything, like, I've been falling in love with it. Like, my husband was like love at first sight. I think, like, the day we landed, like, his eyes were like shiny and open. I was a little bit more skeptical. It took a while for me, but I love it every day more.
Oh, and so let's talk about your time in the States. A graduate from Berkeley, and wow, I mean, everybody that knows music has heard of Berkeley. How was that whole experience for you, Ona Lu? And you get pretty immersed, don't you, in music?
Oh, yes. I don't know. I don't know about other places, but I think it must be like the most immersive musical experience you can have. Just the campus, having so many musicians together, and then like such an amazing offer of classes. You know, you can learn music from all over the world with teachers that are experts in their fields, who are active recording musicians, and just meeting musicians from all over the world and absorbing about their music, their culture, and getting to create all the time. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I when I was in Argentina, I studied classical composition and it was such a different experience. You know, it was like a lot of studying by myself, and it was beautiful. I learned so much, but I think to become the artist I am today, Berkeley was irreplaceable, a priceless experience.
So commenting on that, when you're talking about Berkeley and being around so many musicians and like-minded people like yourself, but you said music from all around the world, I think now this has given you the opportunity to, how we say, stick to your guns, but, you know, your Latin music and your voice and the stories you tell are from the heart. We may not always understand it because it's not in English, but the language of music is universal. And I think now more than ever, we need to be exposed to more different,
yes,
different types of music from other cultures.
Yep, I think it's a fascinating moment in history that we're living with social media and this reach we can have. And I think, like, I'm a bit of an idealist and a pathological optimist, but I think, like, the way to get over and evolve out of discrimination, racial discrimination, mm-hmm, religious, cultural, like, and building a world together is getting to know. Like, I don't know what I've heard it, but it's much harder to hate someone you know. You know? When you know, don't know something, it's easier to judge and to dismiss and to blame or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when you connect with this aspect, that, which music communicates this like no other art almost, when we connect to the things that makes us all the same, that we all share. You know, music talks about human experience, emotion, those things that transcend completely culture or religion or sexual identity. So I think it's a very promising what music can do.
Well,
in this era.
Yeah, well, it certainly is a gift. And let's talk about, you know, your transition from Argentina, and then you went to the States, I know, but then to here now in Winnipeg and having a life. How different would it be if you had not left Argentina? Where would you be now?
Oh, that's such a great question. thank you. I, on one side, when you ask me that, I think, okay, I would be close to my family and friends who I miss so much. It's so hard for me to live far away. But artistically, like since I moved here, I've been able to make a living with my music through performing, through composing, through teaching music. And that's simply like maybe someone does it in Argentina, but it's really hard. Even, and I am from Buenos Aires, which is a city that is boiling with art, but still like there is not like the space for a musician to have a good quality of life and make a living when you are developing an artist like myself. So I'm guessing I would be very happy close to my family and friends, but also maybe more frustrated artistically, maybe not being able to do all I want to do with my art.
Yes, and now, wow, no one could predict what we are living in now for year two. How have you coped, you and your husband, through all of this, you know, pandemic, COVID, isolation, virtual, no live performing?
Well, it's been challenging, not being able to visit Argentina. Mm-hmm. I try to go every 6 months. Now it's been, of course, over a year. But we've both had work, like we're all working, so we haven't felt need, you know, and there's been like great programs to support arts and to support people through this, like in this country, which I am very grateful for. So it's been a challenge, but technology, as I mentioned in my song, is great as long as we don't forget to create real connections, we don't stay on the surface, but through technology, I've been able to still be close and share all these challenging times with my family and friends and also with my friends here.
Yeah, no, it's I know it's no one's written the book about it that says this is what
this is what you have to do. This is so crazy. Who could have imagined we'd be in this position? I mean, some people did, but we didn't listen to them.
Well, so. And case in point, though, a lot of musicians have taken this time and opportunity to write new material, to be inspired in different ways. And congratulations on your beautiful single. I will let you say the title.
Okay.
Like practice.
It's called Bailar de a Dos, which means dance in couples or dance in twos, like dance with someone else. And do you want me to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's like, of course, today it means so much in the literal sense, right? Like we miss, like, for example, I used to dance tango here in Winnipeg with a tango community, beautiful tango community here in Winnipeg. And I'm missing that a lot. And we're all missing like actual human contact, right? But in the context of a song, it's also kind of a metaphor of building life with someone else. And I wrote this song actually around 5 years ago, and thinking about how, you know, sometimes we are culturally pushed to be like over-focused on ourselves, our plans, success, work, our inner peace, our organization, our routine, blah, blah, blah. And And I wrote these songs thinking how real happiness is not, like, all that is good, mm-hmm. it's important, it makes our life, our everyday life enjoyable, mm-hmm. but if you don't have someone to share it with, if you're not building your life, sharing your life with other people, or someone else, or others, mm-hmm. It's not enough, right? Having these individual things, individualism in the end, is not enough.
No, and it's so beautiful, and I tease everybody with a short clip, but a lot of scenes from Winnipeg, and I did recognize a lot of the dancers that you had. So it was just like, oh my goodness, like, you know, here you were, and it's just like this hidden gem. And no, it's a beautiful little video, and it just brought back so many memories of, you know, those warm summer nights when they would have the tango out at the Forks and everybody would be dancing. And, you know, we can only wish and you know, we do have hope that, yes, one day we will return to that. But mm-hmm. I think it'll feel much different.
Yes. Yes. It's going to be a readjustment for sure. But yes, I think, or I hope with all my heart, that mm-hmm. we'll get that back.
Yes.
And that freedom that we enjoyed of getting together, holding each other, kissing each other, traveling through the world whenever we wanted. It was amazing. And I think we'll enjoy it more because yes. we understand better mm-hmm. how blessed we are to have that. And yes, we just have to wait.
Oh, yes, I know. And
act together, right? Mm-hmm. Pandemic showed us that how connected we are, how the whole world is
yes.
connected.
And
something we had such a good hard time understanding, now it's more evident.
No. And if we kind of, if I can go back to people in your life that influenced you for your music, you know, I just want to touch on, you have worked with world-renowned artists and Latin Grammy winners. And it's pretty amazing, Onalu. I mean, it definitely obviously shows in your music, but Rosanna was one that individual.
It's just amazing. And she was a huge influence, like when her very, very big album, she released that. I was 13, 14 years old, and I listened to that album so much. And I had this friend who we love to sing together, and we would just walk through the streets in Buenos Aires singing out loud all her songs. And at that point, I didn't know I wanted to be a musician, or much less a songwriter or an artist, but that no doubt that made a deep mark on how I write songs and how it gave me a channel, mm-hmm. A way to, an outlet for all these emotions, these feelings, and thanks, that was in Berkeley that happened. Mm-hmm. She went to for a talk there, and I got to meet her, and then she was doing some shows, like a US tour, and she's the most generous, amazing woman. And she started like inviting some of the students she was meeting to perform with her. And she was like, many artists would go like, okay, yeah, come maybe do some background vocals there or whatever. She was like, no, she invited me to her New York show to sing in a duo with her. And she made me choose the song, whatever song I wanted. So I got to choose my favorite song from her. Like, who does that?
Oh my goodness. Like that must have been like priceless.
Priceless. Yeah, completely priceless. And it's a lot for someone who is finding their way in the industry. It's very inspiring to meet someone mm-hmm. who's made it, who has created such beautiful music, who had such an impact on so many people, and meet them and see they are great people. It encouraged me to follow on this path.
And no doubt, I think you too, Onalu, would do that to any young woman
yes.
sitting in the audience for your concert or yeah. whatever. Yes,
okay.
No.
Yes, hopefully. I hope someone wants to, and of course I'll invite them.
Well, I want to ask you though, if you could play a song for us. And
sure.
and before we go too, so you have your new single out, and the new album is going to be coming out, correct? May 28th?
Yes. Yes. I'm going to be releasing another single on April 30th, Amor Crónico, Chronic Love. That's the title. And then by the May 28th, I will be releasing the album.
And the album is called?
Super excited. Diamante.
Diamante.
Sí.
Beautiful.
Yes. That's the title of the album. And yeah, I'm so excited. It's been 5 years since I released music. I've been composing, playing like crazy live and stuff, but I haven't been releasing music. So getting this music out again, it's very important to me. And, and it helps me keep the energy and the and the patience and the optimism about everything going.
Yes. Always creating. Well, we can't wait to hear your song. Congratulations.
Do you want me to play Bailar de a Dos or another song or the next release or what would you like?
Maybe the next release.
Okay. Let's do that. Is this sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Otra vez una sonrisa amarga y este temblor en los huesos de saber que la enfermedad es igual al remedio. Solo tenerte, mi amor, me hace efecto, qué adicción irremediable. No sé vivir sin lo que me das, esto es incurable. Aunque sea mi amor, es bien nuestro este dolor. Crónico los dos, enfermos de amor. Necesito una gota más de eso que me das. Crónico los dos, enfermos de amor. No nos vamos a curar, fuego hasta el final. Amor. Vamos juntos haciendo tormentas, cayendo al vacío, abrazados en nuestro propio precipicio de lo no perdonado. Vivimos con el corazón sangrando entre palabras prendidas fuego, en esta lucha hasta las cenizas que solo los dos entendemos. Aunque sea mi amor, es bien nuestro este dolor. Crónicos los dos, enfermos de amor. Necesito una gota más de eso que me das. Crónicos los dos, enfermos de amor. No nos vamos a curar, fuego hasta el final. Amor crónico. Es lo que soy, y si me voy, que sea queriéndote, que sea queriéndote. Crónicos los dos, enfermos de amor. Necesito una gota más de eso que me das. Crónicos los dos, enfermos de amor. No nos vamos a curar, fuego hasta el final. Amor crónico, mi amor crónico.
Welcome back to Heal at Home. Coming up, our life coach, Linda Dostowicz, gives us a lesson on how to show up as yourself.
Hey everyone, happy to be here. I want to talk about showing up as yourself in your business, in your business copy, in your emails, how you present yourself when you're speaking, bringing all parts of yourself to the table. That means not hiding. That means not showing up as the professional version of what you think a woman in business is, but it is to show up with all of your human messiness. Now, that is a challenge for a lot of us because we've been taught that very rightly that women in business, women leaders, women in general are judged. We are judged critically. We are put down for our bodies, our having opinions, our politics, our values. So very rightly, we started to hide parts of ourselves out of protectiveness. And, you know, that was a very good response to a very real threat. However, what you find is that you aren't living your values. You're hiding parts of yourself so that your ideal clients can't find you because you are putting out copy and presenting yourself in such a watered down vanilla version of yourself that people don't really know who you are. They don't really know if they can trust you. They don't know if they want to work with you. So it really is actually a good decision for business to show up more as yourself, to let people see behind the scenes, let people into, you know, your struggles. As a coach, I do not have to be some perfect version of a person who's got their whole life together in order to serve you. I can coach even when things are going wrong in my own life or I'm, you know, having some personal struggle. I can still show up with all of my coaching tools and serve you and help you. I do not have to be a perfect version. In fact, people are drawn to me because they see, you know, I just show up as myself. I am not trying to be better than anyone. I'm not trying to be perfect. I am willing to show my flaws, and that draws people to me because they think, well, I could be real with her. You know, I could show her the person that I want to become, but she would accept who I am right now. So being yourself in business, although there are risks and challenges, and it takes learning how to process those very real feelings of, you know, fear of rejection, vulnerability, it takes learning how to sit with that discomfort when you put out things into the world that show the real you. It's worth taking that risk because you get to show up and live fully in all of your human messy glory. So show up as yourself and let people see who you really are.
We want to give a very special thank you to all of our special guests on today's show and leave you with this question. What family member from your past would you love to have a conversation with and why? We want to know, so send us an email to hello@ilikeyou.com or you can message us on Facebook and Instagram @ilikeyou. But for now, stay safe and healthy and we'll see you next time on Hue at Home. Poco a poco en cada área de la vida cotidiana se hace menos necesario encontrarnos cara a cara. El avance tecnológico es sin duda fascinante, pero hay algunas cosas que se hacían mejor. Thanks for listening. This has been a production of ilikeyou.com. Podcast distribution from the Sound Off Media Company.
Hi. I'm Connie Thiessen, the host of Broadcast Dialogue, the podcast. We focus on Canada and the challenges facing Canadian radio and TV, as well as highlighting those moving the industry forward from podcasting and streaming to new broadcast tech. Check us out at broadcastdialogue.com or your favorite podcast app.
Do, did, will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first five episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all three of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.